The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The general subject, as I understand it, is to explore a little bit the relationship between Christians and the church and the other institutions of society. And by other institutions, one could speak today, I guess, of a wide variety of kinds of things, political institutions and economic institutions and social institutions and all that there is of society out there. So we're going to be talking a little bit this morning of the relationship between Christians and the church, on the one hand, and the rest of the world, on the other hand. Now, not primarily in the sense of evangelism and that sort of thing, but in terms of other sorts of things that are happening today in those interrelationships. Now, let me say one thing, first of all, about which I think all Christians agree, or at least they should, as I understand it, because many of the things I'm going to say today are things about which many Christians do not agree. And I would suspect that many of you that are here today will have some objection to some of the things that I will say, because they won't be accurate, or because they will be unfounded, or because you just plain think they're wrong. But there is one thing about which I think we Christians ought to agree, and that is that the Christian must be involved and concerned about all of the needs of other people in the world. I just don't see how we can get around that. I recalled just before we began today the story of John the Baptist in Matthew chapter 11. And you all remember that incident where John is in prison and he sends his disciples to Jesus. And he wants to know if Jesus is the Messiah. And Jesus doesn't answer the question. Doesn't say yes, doesn't say no. But in Matthew 11, he simply says to John's disciples, "Go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is preached to the poor. Blessed is the man who does not fall away on account of me." I think that Jesus' ministry was marked by concern for all of the needs of people around him. In the Olivet Discourse in Matthew chapter 25, Jesus seems to indicate there very clearly that giving a cup of cold water, that giving clothes to those who are without clothes, that giving food to the hungry is a very important aspect of the Christian life. So I think it's very difficult to argue around the statement that Christians should be involved in every aspect of the needs of their neighbors. I think the love of Christ constrains us. I think the word of Christ commands us. I think the love of Christ controls us to have to do an expression of God's love. Now, as some of you know, there is a bit of a debate here on the campus about the relationship between faith and works. And some of you know that's a little bit more than just a bit of a debate. It's a critical debate. But I think all of us agree as Christians that works is an important part of the Christian experience, an essential part of the Christian experience. So simply to say, "I believe," and to have no interest in the needs of your neighbor as an individual Christian has no place in biblical theology or biblical thinking. So that point, I think, is clear. The Christian must be concerned about all the needs of his neighbor. Now, that doesn't mean he will have enough time to deal with all of those needs, but he's concerned about them. He does what he can to meet those needs. Now, I think it should also be said that what is true of an individual Christian may not be true of the church. What is true of an individual Christian may not be true of a group of Christians, the church. What is true, for example, of a soldier may not be true of an army. A soldier, for example, can get married, but I don't know how an army gets married. So there are certain things that an individual soldier may be called upon to do that an army may not be called upon to do. There are certain things an individual Christian may be called upon to do, maybe, that a church as a whole may not be called upon to do. While I was walking out of the office this morning, I picked up the Westminster Confession, which serves many useful purposes. One of them is to draw lines on here and leave brown ink all over the margin. But in the Westminster Confession, in chapter 31, at paragraph 4, the framers of this document deal to some degree with the relationship between the church and society around it when they say synods and councils are to handle, that's church bodies, are to handle or conclude nothing but that which is ecclesiastical, and are not to intermeddle with civil affairs which concern the commonwealth unless by way of humble petition in cases extraordinary, or by way of advice for satisfaction of conscience, if they be thereunto required by the civil magistrate. So church bodies, synods and councils and sessions, I think that could be included, are to conclude nothing but that which is ecclesiastical, and are not to intermeddle in civil affairs which concern the commonwealth, in our case the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, unless by way of humble petition in cases extraordinary. So there is an exception, unless by way of humble petition in cases extraordinary. So how is the church today to relate to society around it, the structures of society? It's a very big question, a large question. There are whole philosophies written from the direction of the study of that question, and I'm sure some of you have some perspectives on that question that would be very helpful to me. My suspicion is if we have time at the end, you'll share them with me and tell me where I can go for further information. I'll be glad for that. Let me try to develop a bit of a theory with you this morning, and this is mine, and therefore I can't defend it very well. I'm sure it's got some inaccuracies, but I'm going to do it with a bit of a chart, and I was going to do it on the blackboard, but we can't get the screen up. It's been that kind of a day, as a matter of fact. The day began with my realization when I arrived here this morning that I had left all my notes home for what I was going to do this morning. That's where it started, and from there on it's been downhill, and I can't get the screen up. But we're going to draw a bit of a chart, and I can't get all the wording on it here, so I'm just going to tell you what's on it. If you care to write it down, that's fine, but there'll be no exam in this course, and if you don't want to, if you want to do anything else, you just go ahead and do that. But let me tell you what I have on the chart, and then we'll see what we can do with this. What I'm trying to do is evolve a bit of a theory that will help us, perhaps, to begin to understand the relationship between different structures in the world. And you may disagree with this theory, and that's fine. It may be wrong. Up in that, you see that open line up there? If you're drawing this chart, you put up there the Lordship of Christ. And these are going to be three different institutions in society. So up between those lines on the top, put the Lordship of Christ. And what I'm trying to indicate there by those open ends on either end of that box is that the Lordship of Christ encompasses all the institutions of society. For example, if there's another institution here called business, it's under the Lordship of Christ. If there's another institution called family, it's under the Lordship of Christ. If there's another institution called education, it's under the Lordship of Christ. As many institutions as there are, they are all somehow under the Lordship of Christ. And I think that's important. And I think most Christians would believe that, though they might vary in their understanding of it. Now, in this first box, we're going to talk about one of the institutions called church. So this box gets a title on it, church. That's one of the institutions in the world, church. The second box is another institution of society that we're going to call space science. That's a second institution of society, space science. So this box is church, this box is space science, and this box over here is the state. Now, state could be a lot of things, depending on what the issue is. It could be we're in Cheltenham Township. Well, if some issue came up with regard to zoning, let's say some people were being discriminated against in zoning and the church over here thought it should do something about it, then the church should have to consider its relationship to the state. And the state would be Cheltenham Township. Could be the state of Pennsylvania, could be the United States, whatever. This is the state under which we live. Now, the Lord Jesus Christ has a relationship to all these institutions. What is his relationship to the church? He is what in his relationship to the church? Pardon me?
Head.
Head, All right, in a sense, however, he's head of each of these things in some sort of sense. He is the redeemer of Christians in a very specific sense. And understand these terms could be used in different ways. So up on this line right here, I wrote redeemer of Christians. Right on this line, that's his relationship to the church. He is the redeemer of Christians. What's his relationship to space science? What's the primary relationship he has to space science? Creator.
And governor.
And governor. Sustainer, is that okay? Okay, creator and sustainer of the universe. That's his relationship to space science. If he weren't those things, space science, as I see it, would be absolutely impossible if Jesus Christ were not creator and sustainer of the universe. I surely wouldn't want to go to Mars or the moon or anywhere else unless Jesus Christ were the sustainer of the universe, unless he held it all together. And that's the only possibility, as I understand it, for science to do anything at all, is that Jesus Christ holds it all together. Now, a scientist doesn't have to know that. He can be just as good a scientist, I think, if he's a pagan or a Hindu or a Muslim, as if he's a Christian. But the truth of the matter is, it still all holds together in Jesus, whether he knows it or not. Now, he can learn his science and just be a wonderful scientist without knowing that. But that's the truth of the matter. So, Jesus sustains a relationship to space science in that he is the creator and the sustainer of the universe. What's his relationship to the state? How is he related to the state? How is he related to Ronald Reagan? Pardon me?
Governor.
Governor? Okay. Where does Reagan get his authority?
Constitution.
Constitution, but beyond that.
God.
Jesus Christ is the appointer of kings. He is the appointer of kings. They are responsible to him. So the state gets its authority from Jesus, whether or not it knows that. Again, that's irrelevant. The Roman Empire had got its authority from Jesus, whether in fact it knew it or not. So here are three institutions of society, of life, that have different kinds of relationships to Jesus. And you know, you could tie all this together. He's the redeemer of all of these institutions. I'm just trying to make some kinds of distinctions. Here are three institutions that have a relationship to Jesus. Now down here, I listed some topics, and then I'm going to go across and fill in the boxes a little bit. And the first topic is authority, and this one's easy. Where do these institutions get their authority to function? And the answer to each one is from God. So what I did was write here, authority from God, from God, from God. All these institutions derive their authority from God. And you could do that right across the board. If you put in here family and education and whatever else we had, whatever institution there is in society derives its authority from God. Now, what is the origin? That's the next topic. What is the origin of these different institutions? Where does the church originate? What is its origin? Now, again, there are many answers that one could give to this, and I could ask, you know, we could just kick it around, but I have on my chart that the church derives its origin from the cross. The church originates at the cross. Now, you know, you can go backwards and forwards and do all kinds of things with that, but I have origin the cross. Where does space science originate? Where does it get its origin?
Creation.
Specifically where in creation?
Cultural mandate,
which is what?
Dominion.
Have dominion over the earth. God told man, you shall have dominion over the earth. Subdue the earth. That's the mandate of space science. Subdue the earth. Now, I'll grant you there's a little bit of extension to go from earth to the moon, but I don't think you'd have much problem with that. At least I don't. So the mandate and the origin of space science is to subdue the earth. How about the state? Where does it get its origin? What's the origin of the state? Why is there a state at all? Why do we need government? Where did it originate?
Ordained of God.
Okay, ordained of God, but why? I know this is not an easy question. I'm not sure I have a good answer, but
order of man.
because of sin, for one reason. So the origin of the state, I think, could be said to be sin. If it weren't for sin, I'm willing to debate this, and I'm not sure I'm right. If it weren't for sin, we wouldn't need a state. One could argue that, perhaps. So the origin of the state could be sin. Or the origin of the state could be, and one might say this, God's grace. Did God by grace give man the state organization because of sin? Or is it simply the need for organization? As you get more people, you need to be more highly organized. When there's only Adam and Eve, you hardly need a township and a state and a nation and a United Nations when only two people. So maybe it's just that there were more people. But the origin of the state is somewhere back there in the Old Testament, I think, mixed up with the larger number of people, sin, and God's grace. Now, under what mandates do these different institutions function? What is the mandate of the church? If the church's origin is in the cross, under what mandate does it function? And I have two words after I fished all around for an answer to this. And the two words that I have for the mandate of the church are communication, and mobilization. If the church operates under two mandates, and one of them is to communicate with the world out there, and the other is to mobilize itself for communication. This is mandate now. We talked about origin, and the origin of the church is the cross, and the mandate of the church is mobilization and communication. How about space science? We've already mentioned that. Its origin is man's high calling. What is its mandate? Subdue the earth. What's the mandate of the state? What is the state supposed to do? What does God command the state to do, as you understand the Bible?
Maintain order.
Pardon me? Maintain order? Pardon me?
Minister justice.
Okay. Pardon me? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Keep the law. Establish the law, perhaps. Keep the law.
Protection.
Okay. Now, a lot of these things relate to some things that are biblical. I mean, they all do, and some of you could find Bible verses to substantiate these. Paul Woolley, who many of you know well and who taught here for many years, wrote a little booklet. What is it, Church and Family and State or something like that? You ought to read that if you're interested at all in this subject. Very readable, very brief, very suggestive in many ways. I think you'd enjoy it. But the mandate of the state, then, is something like to punish evil, to promote good, something in those directions, to promote peace and prosperity, to maintain peace so that the gospel can spread, that sort of thing. Two other subjects here. First one is, who are the subjects in these different institutions? Who are the subjects in the institution called church? Who are the subjects in the church? Who are the people in the church? They are believers, Christians. Okay? Who are the subjects in space science, that institution? They are scientists. Who are the subjects in the state?
Everyone.
Citizens. Okay. Now, somebody could conceivably be all three of these. He could be a Christian scientist who lives in a certain state. But he might function differently then. He might function as a Christian in all cases, but he might have different responsibilities as a citizen from what he has as a space scientist. Finally, then, let's do one other comparison. I want to talk about tools. The typical tools, T-O-O-L-S, that these different institutions use. Tell me about the tools that typify the church. What weaponry does the church have?
The means of grace.
The means of grace. Describe them for me in one word. Spiritual. The tools, the T-O-O-L-S, that the church has at its disposal are spiritual, basically. That's a pretty important distinction. Because today, there are many people within Christendom who are suggesting that the church should be using other kinds of tools. And I'm not sure they're entirely wrong. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not just here to tirade against some view out there. But I think this is an interesting point and a point to just slow down a little bit. The tools that typically belong to the church are spiritual. What tools belong to space scientists? What is the tool of their business?
Technology,
whatever. Genius. Okay, that's the tool, typical tool here. Technology, genius, however you want to describe it. That's their typical tool. What's the typical tool of the state? What's the tool that marks the state?
Force.
No, force.
Sword.
If law is all there is, it's not enough. So the typical tool of the state is the sword. Now here's a theory, and you're free to disagree with it. You're free to say that's simplistic. Do whatever you want with it. Here are three institutions. When does the church, if ever, have the right to speak to or try to influence these other institutions? And I have a suggestion that I've worked a little bit with. I think the church, for example, has the right to speak to this institution or this one or this one or this one or whatever one whenever this institution either breaks out of its box or does not fulfill God's purpose for it. Now, by breaking out of its box, I mean if this institution tries to invade the rights of this institution can say, hey, get back in your box where you belong. If the state tries to take over the prerogatives of the church, I think the church has the right to say, that's not your business. Get back over there where God intends you to be and do your thing. Or if the state invades the prerogatives of the family, I think the church has the right to say, and the Westminster Confession says by way of humble petition, I think the church has the right to say, hey, get back over there and do your thing, let the family do its thing. And this would take a lot of definition now as far as the family is concerned. Or if the church, if the state breaks out of its box that way and usurps the lordship of Christ, and denies the lordship of Christ. That doesn't mean the state needs to be Christian, whatever that would mean, I'm not exactly sure. But if the state usurps the lordship of Christ and says, worship me, or denies the lordship of Christ, then I think the church has the right to say, hey, wait, get back in your box where you belong. So there's a theory, as far as the relationship is concerned, between the church and the other institutions of society. Now, we could use some examples, perhaps helpfully, maybe. You go back to Hitler's Germany, and many of you know more about that historical period than I do, but was there a time, maybe when the Barman Declaration was issued, maybe before, I don't know, when Hitler's Germany did not do what God intended it to do, instead usurped the lordship of Christ, and where the church had perhaps the right and the demand to say, even by way of humble petition, but clearly, you are not fulfilling the mandate that God intended for you, and to say that very clearly. These are very delicate issues, very difficult issues with which to deal. And this is theoretical. This is a theory now of the relationship between institutions and among institutions of society. What I'd like to do, and we don't have a lot of time, but I'd like to mention one area today that's of special interest to me, and maybe to some of you, I don't know, but it's a very interesting area to me. And that has to do with the church's relationship to business. Now, I don't have a box here for business. I haven't worked that out. Maybe I can't. I don't know. But I don't have a box for business. But today, as many of you know, the church, and by church I mean Christendom as a whole, the church has become very involved in the life of business. It's almost unavoidable. Jesus said, as you may recall, that we should not lay up for ourselves treasures on earth. But most churches have not felt that that means that they should get rid of all of their capital assets. You know, give away all their money and sell all their buildings and that sort of thing, close all their bank accounts. And most churches and most Christians, like it or not, have some relationship with big business. And that creates some very interesting situations today. The institution called church related to the institution called business. Your church probably has some stock. I don't know that. you know, some stock, somebody died, left you some stock, and you don't know what to do with it. There it sits, you have 100 shares of ATT, and the trustees look at it every month and get the dividends or whatever. Maybe they don't have that. So you say, we're not related to business. So you've got money in a bank somewhere, your checking account, out of which you pay your pastor, or out of which you are paid as the pastor. And that money that you put in the bank then lends to ATT. So they are lending your money to big business, and big business is functioning with the money that the people have contributed to your church. It's pretty hard today not to be related to business in some way. Now, how should the church be related to business? That's a tough question. John Alexander is the editor of The Other Side, which, as many of you know, is an evangelical publication that tries to call attention to the social issues of our day in a way that some of us would say is over toward the radical side. He's a radical evangelical. I think that'd be fair. He said, a central cause of the world's social problems is the concentration of economic power in the hands of a few profit-oriented corporations. A central cause of the problems in the world today, he says, is the concentration of economic power in the hands of a few profit-oriented corporations. Now, how do you deal with that statement? Well, there are two extremes, and maybe you take one or the other. A lot of us tend to be extremists whenever there's an issue like this. One extreme is to say there is absolutely no need to question the church's attack against business. The enemy in the world today is business. And those kinds of people will say that the enemy is Alcoa, or Amex, or GE, or GM, or IBM, or ITT. That's the enemy. Go get them. And the issues, those people will say, are strip mining, or equal employment, or international affairs, or union recognition, or baby formulas. And baby formulas have been right in the paper lately, as all of you know. And so what those people will do is mobilize things like boycotts and resolutions, and they will undergird them with pressure and publicity, and what you have is the church against the corporations. That's one extreme. The other extreme backs up against the other wall. These people are all backed up against that wall. And the other extreme which backs up against that wall, and maybe some of you identify with this group, and maybe properly, don't misunderstand me. The other extreme says the church has no business meddling in business. Church is church, business is business. Stick to the high calling that you have and simply preach the gospel. Those are two extremes. Let me share with you some data that is 1 year out of date now, and I apologize for that. I just got a copy of Fortune magazine with last year's data in it. I just haven't had the opportunity to upgrade it, but let me share with you some data. 1978, General Motors sales totaled $63 billion. Let me put that number on the board just to see if I can write it. 63, let's see, that's million, that's billion. General Motors sales, $63 billion, General Motors, in 1978. I don't know whether that's up or down now. I would have said, you know, automatically up, except they've got some problems. It's still going up even in spite of the problems. Okay. General Motors sales were $63 billion. Exxon sales were $60 billion, 1978. Sears Roebuck sold $18 billion worth of hammers and socks and things like that, $18 billion. For its efforts, now this has changed. For its efforts, General Motors showed an income in 1978 of $3.5 billion. $3,500,000,000 income. That's profit. Profit, $3,500,000 profit, 1978. Exxon had a profit of $2.8 billion, Sears Roebuck $1 billion. The gross national product, that's the total of all goods and services produced by a company, for Zimbabwe was $3 billion. In 1978. The whole country of Zimbabwe, which was then Rhodesia, country is on the front page of the newspaper almost every day, or at least it was for a while, and it still gets there once in a while. The gross national product, the total of all goods and services produced in the country of Zimbabwe, was $3 billion. in the same year. This is just some data to help you see what the problem looks like. Israel, $15 billion. The gross national product of the country of Israel in 1978 was one-fourth as big as the production of General Motors. Egypt, $16 billion. South Africa, $38 billion. Switzerland, $55 billion. Now, I'm trying to help you to see a little bit the size of the issue that's at hand. It's not a trivial thing. It's a big thing. General Motors in 1978 had 800,000 employees. Now, many of you can think of cities that are smaller than that. Big cities, 800,000 employees, 1978. In the New Yorker, not long ago, somebody wrote this: global corporations have grown so fast that their combined total sales exceed the gross national product of every country except the United States and the Soviet Union. Now, many of us have fallen into the delusion of thinking this is all a big American thing. You know, it's just all these American corporations going out all over the world, these transnational corporations. Don't fall into that pattern. I had to learn to escape that pattern. Among the biggest countries in the world are Royal Dutch Shell. That's not American. Or British Petroleum. Or Toyota. Toyota's sales, as I understand earlier this year, surpassed those of General Motors. And that ought to tell us something about what's going on in the world today in terms of big business. I used to own a Toyota, and one of the problems I always had was finding parts for it. And it's just a curious world in which we live. But the last part I bought was a tailpipe in a Paoli auto parts store. Paoli is a suburb near here in South New where we live. And it was really curious to me that I got this tailpipe, and it had stamped on it, made in South Africa. So for in America, for my Japanese car, I bought a tailpipe that was made in South Africa. Japanese company. So I just think there's absolutely no question about it that the power and potential influence of multinational business is awesome. And I'm just trying to give you a little data to think about. As capital moves, as money moves from one sphere of the world to another, those who control that capital gain new authority in that country, tremendous authority. IBM goes into a country with all of its new technology, new methodology, new advertising, more power. These are very powerful institutions, more powerful than most nations. Some strange things have been happening in the last, I guess one would say, two decades. Some people have been calling, for example, for a corporate social audit, that companies should run a social audit of what they're doing. And things are changing, and companies are assuming more social responsibility today, I think in part because of external pressure. All of this is based on a strange theory. And I was interested to read this. In 1970, George Cabot Lodge wrote this. And this is interesting. You can't write all this down, but just try to catch this because I think it's interesting. The opinion is heard that if business wanted to, if it were socially responsible, it could effectively address the problems that plague our major cities, such as poverty, housing, unemployment, and even transportation and education. It could wipe out the dreadful blight of pollution. And it could even set about the establishment of a new world order through the workings of multinational enterprises. The opinion, he's saying, is widely held that business could do anything. And it's strange. Everybody seems to hold that view. This view is held, oddly enough, says George Cabot Lodge, this was in the Harvard Business Review, this view is held, oddly enough, by government leaders, businessmen, liberals, conservatives, and bomb-throwing extremists alike, and as a reflection of the traditional American myth that business is nearly omnipotent. Curious. Almost everybody believes, except, I guess, people right in business, almost everybody believes that if business really wanted to, it could change anything. And you think about it. Politicians, radicals, conservatives, liberals, almost everybody holds to that kind of a view. Business today and big corporations touch virtually every aspect of our lives. And so the question is, what should we do about it? What should the church do about it? What should the church do, if anything, about this enterprise, this other institution called business? Well, there are certain weapons that are at the church's disposal. One of those weapons is people. Employees and employers. And I think most Christians would agree that the tool that the church has at its disposal, namely its Christian members who are employees or employers, should try to influence business for good. I don't know how anyone could argue with that. That somebody who is a Christian here in the institution called church and who is an employer or employee over here in the institution called business should influence business for good. Because he's still a Christian. You don't stop being a Christian when you start being a space scientist or a citizen or an employee. So certainly one of the weapons that people, that the church has at its disposal is people. Some people would say that that's sufficient. That's all the church should do. And they may be right. Many of you here would hold that kind of view, I suspect, if you've ever thought through these kinds of things at all. And you would say that that's all the church should do in relationship to business. Its people, as individual Christians, should influence that aspect of society called business as employers and employees. Sometimes, however, I have read articles defending that point of view that seem to me to be more based on Wall Street dicta. You know, what's good for General Motors is good for the country, or the business of business is business. And I really question sometimes whether that theory is based on New Testament principles and biblical principles or whether it's based on business principles. But it's certainly a theory that many people have held with some degree of wisdom, I think, that the only relationship that the church should have to business is people. What about moral suasion, moral persuasion? That's another tool that's available for the church, moral persuasion. An official local or national church body could indicate moral responsibility to a certain business or to society as a whole. Could pass resolutions, for example, and say, we urge upon such and such business to do thus and so. Or we urge, in relation to society, we urge the township of Cheltenham to do so and so in relation to its zoning. Moral suasion, that's another tool at the church's disposal. Now, each of those tools are relatively passive. And I think most of us would agree that at some time, each of those tools would be proper to be used by the church. But today, there are people who are promoting the use of other kinds of tools. For example, the boycott. That's another kind of tool. People, persuasion, the boycott. We are being told today by some of our Christian brothers and sisters that we should not eat certain kinds of grapes, or that we shouldn't sleep on certain kinds of sheets. Not those that are made by J.P. Stevens, although maybe that's solved now. We shouldn't wear certain kinds of slacks, not Farrah, although maybe that's solved now. Or eat certain kinds of chocolate, certainly not Nestle. We're even being told by some people in Christendom that we shouldn't meet in a hotel that doesn't have an EEO/AA plan in organization, in working. Or we shouldn't meet in a state that hasn't supported the ERA. Now, all those things are boycotts of one kind or another. And we would say, perhaps, that's more of that social activist liberal emphasis, and we certainly can't have that. Let me remind you that in 1910, the United Presbyterian Church, that's 1910, it's a long time ago, most of us here trace our heritage from that church by one route or another. In 1910, the United Presbyterian Church stated, quote, "We solemnly admonish our people to keep themselves financially and politically separate from the liquor traffic." That's a boycott. "To the end that this traffic may by organic law be expelled from our land and our people be saved from its despoiling influence." That's a boycott. That same General Assembly said this, "The General Assembly urges on all our families not to buy anything on the Sabbath." That's a boycott. Now, it may not, you know, you may not like it, but it's a boycott. More recently, evangelicals called for the boycott of Ugandan coffee. noting that much of the revenue went directly to Idi Amin's support. I have an article in my file from his magazine, which is recognized as being relatively conservative, saying you shouldn't buy Ugandan coffee. That's a boycott. Even the most conservative Christians have advocated boycotts. Bob Jones Jr., and I think that's a conservative background, urged a boycott of General Motors if it sponsored an objectionable television special on the life of Jesus 2 years ago. That's a boycott. Others, through advertising, urge us to buy American. That's a boycott. Or use Christian Yellow Pages. I would probably, from my experience, use Christian Yellow Pages to learn who from whom not to buy. Okay, so there's another weapon, the boycott. Here's another weapon, the use of investment capital. That's another weapon, the use of investment capital. Churches have money to invest, and some of the more liberal, larger denominations have been doing what they call creative investment. And they have gone out looking for risky things that minority people are trying to do, for example. That's called creative investment. Is that a valid tool for the church to use? I don't have the answer to that. Not simply, I don't. The churches have tremendous capital resources. I don't know who knows. I don't think anybody knows. How much capital does the church have at its disposal? If you add up every church, whole denominations, all kinds of mission agencies, pension funds, endowed Christian education institutions, billions and billions and billions of dollars. Think of the power that the church has in this direction. Creative investment. Another weapon is divestiture. That is, you sell the stock. You don't like what a company's doing and you happen to have stock in it, you sell it. For example, maybe your church has stock in Coca-Cola Company, let's say. And Coca-Cola Company takes over as a subsidiary a liquor-producing company, and you don't want to be a part of that. So you divest yourself from the stock. That's a tool you have. It's a negative vote. It's sort of a passive negative vote. Probably the most unique tool that the churches as a whole, now I'm talking about Christendom, the whole situation now, have started to use is the shareholder resolution. The shareholder resolution. In New York, there is the office of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. It's in the headquarters of where the National Council of Churches is, 475 Riverside Drive. Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. This is an alliance of a number of different religious organizations that try to promote pressure on various businesses in the United States and really all over the world. 2 years ago, 14 Protestant denominations and 175 Roman Catholic religious communities cooperated in this organization. 14 Protestant denominations, 175 Roman Catholic communities cooperated together and submitted 104 resolutions to businesses in the United States, shareholder resolution. They dealt with things like this, agribusiness, nutrition, television advertising, community reinvestment, domestic equality, energy, infant formulas, military, transnational corporations, and human development. The shareholder resolution, that's a very curious tool. General Motors, for example, was asked that it would adopt a policy whereby no televised advertising for any product will be directed to audiences primarily composed of children 8 or younger. The churches banded together at a shareholders meeting to present that resolution. Coca-Cola resolutions said that a policy should be adopted with regard to employee rights in all of its subsidiaries. Sears had a resolution. J.P. Stevens had a resolution. Mobil had a resolution. Now, what happens to those resolutions? Many of them fail. If the hierarchy of the business, if the leaders of the business support it, and I only know of one instance in which that really happened, They got 97% of the vote. If management said, we endorse this resolution, and it only happened in one instance I know about, they got 97% of the vote. Generally, these shareholder resolutions get somewhere between, say, 2 and 7 or 8% of the vote. Now, that's very important, 2 to 8%. My understanding is if you get 3%, you have the right to present it again the next year. If you get less than 3%, you cannot present it again next year. So you'd say, well, these things always fail, these shareholder resolutions. I don't know that I would say that. Think of the publicity that church people get out of these resolutions for the subjects that they're trying to push. For example, the American churches, again, Christendom as a whole, have a great concern about South Africa and its social situation. And I happen to know a fair amount about that since my wife and I traveled in South Africa for 3 weeks. I was writing a research paper on the relation between churches and corporations, and the South African government learned about it and invited me as its guest to come for 3 weeks and survey the situation. And Jane was also able to come if we were willing to travel tourist class on the airplane. We were very happy to do, and had a tremendous experience and visited government leaders and church leaders and business leaders. But the American churches have an agenda for South Africa, a political agenda. IBM, I believe, is one of the most creative companies in South Africa in terms of trying to upgrade the situation of the black people. And I have been to New York and been to this Interfaith Center and talked to the leaders there, and they believe it too. They believe IBM is a very creative company in South Africa and trying to do the right thing. So what do they do? They present a shareholder resolution to IBM, urging IBM to change its policies in South Africa and make them even more creative. And why do they do that? Because of the publicity they can get for the social agenda that they have. And so they parade outside the IBM shareholder meeting. They're on national television. They're in all the magazines. And all of this can be done relatively inexpensively. It's all done at an Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility in New York with a small staff of, six full-time people representing 14 denominations. All they have to do is get a shareholder resolution into the minutes, and they're in business, and they get worldwide publicity for their social agenda. Shareholder resolution. Now, it's time to quit. As I understand, we're probably supposed to quit at 12. I haven't really told you what's right and what's wrong. I've tried to share with you some of the issues that are going on in the world as I see them in relation to the church's relationship to society. Maybe you ought to think through some of these things. I preached not long ago in a church not far from here, and it happened to be just after their annual meeting, and so their annual report was in the vestibule, and I didn't have anything else to do, so I picked it up and read it. I saw that they had something like $20,000 or $30,000 in stock. IBM and AT&T and 3Ms and whatever else, I don't know, but you know, basic companies, and I don't know whether somebody had died and left this stock to the church or not, but anyway, they had this stock, and the trustees were presenting their annual report as to what had happened to the stock. And I began thinking about that a little bit. I'm sure that if I had said on that Sunday morning, your church owns stock, therefore you are the owner of IBM. It's not as though it's over there. You own it. It's your company. You own it. You own AT&T. It's not as though somebody else owns it and is responsible for it. You own it. Now, if I had said that to them and therefore said, you have some social responsibility in Indonesia because it seems as though IBM is maltreating its employees there, I think they would have said, he's a liberal. You know, we just have no time for that. We can't discuss that. We've got to be busy about preaching the gospel. I don't think it's quite that simple. I don't think it's quite that simple. Now maybe the solution conceivably is that you simply sell the stock, or you put the money in some kind of trust fund or something. You just get rid of it because you say, we don't have time for that agenda. But what should the church do today? That's the question I want to leave you with relation to the other institutions of society, especially this one that is so critical because it's so big. And that is the transnational corporation. The transnational corporation. IBM has offices, I assume, in virtually every country in the world. My suspicion is that IBM can communicate more quickly with its offices than the United States government can with its. What should be done with that? Control data from what I understand, and some of these other computer companies, are going to take the whole game of education before long away from the universities, and they're going to run it. They're going to run it. Control Data now offers an MBA degree by computer. And as I understand, there are 8 universities that are willing to award that degree if you go through the Control Data program. And those universities, I think, are very foolish, because very soon Control Data is going to offer the whole thing. And you'll go downtown to the Control Data Center here, and you will get your whole college education right there. Or at home. Give it 10 years, and you'll do it at home, the whole thing. No more need for universities. These big companies are a very critical part of our life now and forever, until the Lord comes. I don't see any other way around it. And I think we need to give some serious attention to the matter. And I don't have the answers. I just have some questions. But I think some of the questions are worth asking.